Paul burst out before Aaron could speak. They were victims. They got killed because of magic, and it can't be fixed. Not even by your enemy of death, right? There was a shocked silence. Even people who had been involved in other conversations in other parts of the bus turned around and gaped at Cole. His father had blamed the other mages for his mother's death, and he trusted his dad, he did. But with all of their eyes on him, Cole wasn't sure what to think. The silence was broken only by the sound of Master Rockmaple snoring. The bus had turned onto a bumpy dirt path. Very quietly, Celia said,
"I hear there are chaos-ridden animals near the school. From the enemy's experiments."
"Like horses?" Drew asked.
"I hope not,"
Tamara said with a shudder. Drew looked disappointed.
"You wouldn't want a chaos-ridden horse if you had one. Chaos-ridden creatures are the enemy's servants. They've got a piece of the void in them, and it makes them smarter than other animals, but bloodthirsty and insane. Only the enemy or one of his servants can control them."
"So they'd be like evil-possessed zombie horses?" Drew asked.
"Not exactly. You'd know them by their eyes. Their eyes coruscate, pale with spiraling colors inside of them, but otherwise, they just look regular."
"That's the scary part," put in Gwenda. "I hope we don't have to go outside much."
"I do," said Tamara. "I hope we learn how to recognize and kill them. I want to do that."
"Oh, yeah," Cole said under his breath. "I'm the crazy one. Nothing to worry about at the old magisterium. Evil pony school, here we come."
But Tamara wasn't paying attention to him. She was leaning out from her seat, listening to Celia say,
"I hear there's a new type of chaos ridden, where you can't tell from the eyes. The creature doesn't even know what it is, until the enemy makes it do what he wants. So, like, your cat could be spying on you, or..."
The bus stopped with a jerk. For a second, Cole thought maybe they'd gone to another gas station, but then Master Rufus rose to his feet.
"We've arrived," he said. "Please, file off the bus in an orderly fashion."
And for a few minutes, everything was really ordinary, as if Cole were just on a field trip. Kids grabbed their luggage and bags and jostled toward the front of the bus. Cole got off just after Aaron and, since he didn't have to collect any baggage, was the first one to really take a second to look around. Chapter 5. Cole was standing in front of a sheer mountain face. To the left and right was forest, but in front of him was a set of massive double doors. They were a weathered gray color with iron hinges that turned into curved swirls bending inward on one another. Cole imagined that from a distance, or without the glow of the bus headlights, they would have been nearly invisible. Carved into the rock over the doors was an unfamiliar symbol. Beneath it were the words, "Fire wants to burn, water wants to flow, air wants to rise, earth wants to bind, chaos wants to devour."
Devour.
The word sent a shiver through him.
"Last chance to run," he thought.
But he wasn't very fast, and there was nowhere to run to anyway. The other kids had gotten their gear and were now standing around like he was. Master Rufus walked to the doors, and all of them grew quiet. Master North stepped forward.
"You are about to enter the halls of the Magisterium," he said. "For some of you, this may be the fulfillment of a dream. For others, we hope it may be the beginning of one. To all of you, I say, the Magisterium exists here for your own safety. You have a great power. and without training that power is dangerous. Here, we will help you to learn, control, and teach you about the great history of mages like yourself, dating back through time. Each of you has a unique destiny. One outside the normal path you might have walked. One you will find here. You may have guessed this when you saw the first stirrings of your power. But as you stand at the entrance to the mountain, I imagine at least a few of you are wondering just what you've gotten yourselves into. Some of the kids laughed self-consciously. Long ago, in the very beginning, the first mages wondered much the same thing. Intrigued by the teachings of the alchemists, particularly Paracelsus, they sought to explore elemental magic. They had limited success until one alchemist realized that his young son was able to easily do the same exercises with which he struggled. The mages discovered that magic could be performed by those with an inborn power, and was performed best by the young. After that, the mages found new students to teach and to learn from, seeking all over Europe for children with power. Very few have it, perhaps 1 in 25,000, but the mages gathered up those they could and began the first school of magic. Along the way, they heard stories of untrained boys and girls who had set fire to houses and burned in the flames, who had drowned in rainstorms, or had been drawn up into tornadoes or pulled down into sinkholes. With teaching, the mages learned to walk through lava, unscathed, to explore the deepest parts of the sea without an oxygen tank, even to fly. Something inside Call leaped at what Master North was saying. He remembered being very small and asking his father to swing him through the air, but his dad wouldn't and told him to stop pretending. Could he really learn how to fly? If you could fly, whispered a small, treacherous part of his brain, it wouldn't matter so much that you can't run. Here, you will encounter elementals, creatures of great beauty and danger that have existed in our world since the dawn of time. You will shape earth, air, water, and fire, bending them to your will. You will study our past as you become our future. You will discover what your ordinary self would never have had the privilege to see. You will learn great things, and you will do greater things. Welcome to the Magisterium. There was applause. Call looked around. Everyone's eyes were shining, and as much as he fought against it, he was sure he looked the same. Master Rufus stepped forward.
Tomorrow, you will see more of the school. But for tonight, follow your masters and get yourselves settled in your rooms. Please, stay close as they lead you through the Magisterium. The tunnel system is complex, and until you know it well, it's easy to become lost.
Lost in the tunnels, Call thought. It was the exact thing he'd been scared of since he'd first heard of this place. He shivered as he remembered his nightmare about being trapped underground. Some of his doubts were creeping back, his father's warnings echoing in his head. But they're going to teach me how to fly, he thought, as though arguing with someone who wasn't there. Master Rufus held up one large hand, fingers splayed, and said something under his breath. The metal of his wristband began to glow, as though it had turned white hot. A moment later, with a loud creaking that sounded almost like a scream, the doors began to open. Light poured out from between them, and the kids moved forward, gasping and exclaiming. Call overheard a lot of cool and awesome. A minute later, he had to grudgingly admit it was kind of awesome.
There was a vast entrance hall, bigger than any inside space Call could have ever imagined. It could have held 3 basketball courts and still have room left over. The floor was the same glittering mica he'd seen in the illusion back at the airplane hangar, but the walls were covered with flowstone, which made it look like thousands of melting candles had slicked the walls in dripped wax. Stalagmites rose up all along the edges of the room, and huge stalactites hung down, nearly touching one another in places. There was a river, a bright glowing blue like luminous sapphire cutting through the room, flowing in through an archway in one wall and out through another, a carved rock bridge crossing it. Patterns were cut into the sides of the bridge, patterns Call didn't recognize yet, but they reminded him of the markings on the dagger his dad had thrown to him. Call hung back, as all the apprentices from the trial flooded in around him, forming a knot in the middle of the room. His leg felt stiff from the long bus ride, and he knew he would be moving slower than ever. He hoped it wasn't a long walk to where they were supposed to sleep. The huge doors closed behind them with a crash that made Call jump. He spun around just in time to see a row of sharply pointed stalactites, one after another, drop from the roof and thud into the ground, effectively blocking off the doors. Drew, behind Call, swallowed audibly. "But how are we supposed to get back out?" "We're not," Call said, happy to have an answer for this, at least. "We're not ever supposed to get out." Drew edged away. Call supposed he couldn't blame him, though he was getting a little tired of being treated like a freakazoid, just for pointing out the obvious. A hand took hold of his sleeve. "Come on." It was Aaron. Call turned and saw that Master Rufus and Tamara were already starting to move. Tamara had a swagger in her step that hadn't been there before, under the watchful eyes of her parents. Muttering under his breath, Call followed the 3 of them through one of the archways and into the tunnels of the Magisterium. Master Rufus held up one hand, and a flame appeared in his palm, flickering like a torch. It reminded Call of the fire resting on the water in the final test. He wondered what he should have done to really fail. To fail in a way that wouldn't have meant his coming here. They walked, one by one, through a narrow corridor that smelled faintly of sulfur. It spilled into another room, this one with a series of pools, one of which bubbled away muddily, and another full of pale, eyeless fish that dispersed at the sound of the human's footfalls. Call wanted to make a joke about how chaos-ridden, eyeless fish might be undetectable if they were servants of the enemy of death because, well, no eyes. But he managed to creep himself out instead, imagining them spying on all the students. Next, they came upon a cavern with 5 doors set into its far wall. The first was made of iron, the second, copper, the third, bronze, the fourth, silver, and the last of gleaming gold. All of the doors reflected the fire in Master Rufus's hand, making flames dance eerily in the mirror of their polished surfaces. High above him, Call thought he saw the flash of something shining, something with a tail, something that moved quickly into the shadows and was gone. Master Rufus didn't lead them into the cavern and through any of the doors, but kept them walking until they came to a big, round, high-ceilinged room with 5 arched passageways leading in as many different directions. On the ceiling, Call spotted a group of lizards with gems on their backs, some seeming to burn with blue flames.
"Elementals!"
Tamara gasped.
"This way,"
Master Rufus said. The first words he'd spoken, his sonorous voice echoing in the empty space. Call wondered where all the other magicians were. Maybe it was later than he thought, and they were asleep. But the emptiness of the rooms they'd passed through made it seem that they were all alone here. Underground. Finally, Master Rufus stopped in front of a large square door with a metal panel on the front where a door knocker would usually be. He raised his arm, and his wristband glowed again. This time a quick flash of light. Something clicked inside the door, and it swung open.
"Can we do that?"
Aaron asked in an awed voice. Master Rufus smiled down at him.
"Yes. You certainly will be able to get into your own rooms with your wristbands, although you won't be able to go everywhere. Come inside your room and see where you're all going to spend the iron year of your apprenticeship."
"Iron year?" Call echoed, thinking of the doors. Master Rufus went inside, sweeping his arm around what looked like a combination living room and study area. The cave walls were high and arced upward to a dome. From the center of the dome hung a huge coppery chandelier. It had a dozen curving arms, each carved with designs of flame, each holding a burning torch. On the stone floor were three desks grouped in a loose circle and two deep, plush sofas facing each other in front of a fireplace big enough to roast a cow in. Not just a cow. A pony. Cole thought of Drew and hid a sideways smile.
"It's amazing," Tamara said, turning around to look at everything.
For a moment, she seemed like a regular kid rather than a mage from some ancient mage family. Veins of bright quartz and mica ran through the stone walls, and as the torchlight hit them, they became a pattern of five symbols like those over the entrance: a triangle, a circle, three wavy lines, an arrow pointing up, and a spiral. Fire, earth, water, air, and chaos, said Aaron. He must have been paying attention on the bus.
"Very good," said Master Rufus.
"Why are they arranged like that?" Call asked, pointing.
"It makes the symbols into a kinkunks. And now, these are for you."
He lifted three wristbands off a table that seemed carved out of a single piece of rock. They were wide, leather bands with a strip of iron riveted into the cuffs and fastened with a buckle of the same metal. Tamara picked hers up as though it were some kind of holy object.
"Wow!"
"Are they magic?" asked Cole, eyeing his skeptically.
"These wristbands mark your progression through the Magisterium. Providing that you pass your test at the end of the year, you'll earn a different metal. Iron, then copper, bronze, silver, and finally, gold. Once you complete your gold year, you will be considered no longer an apprentice, but a journeyman mage, able to enter the Collegium. In answer to your question, Cole, yes, these are magic. They've been made by a metal shaper and act as keys, allowing you access to classrooms in the tunnels. You will get additional metals and stones to attach to your cuff, signifying your achievements, so that by the time you graduate, it will be a reflection of your time here."
Master Rufus went over to a small kitchen area. Above an odd-looking stove with circles of stones where burners usually went, he reached into a cabinet and brought down three empty wooden plates.
"We generally find it better to let new apprentices settle in their rooms the first night, instead of getting overwhelmed in the refectory. So you'll eat here this evening."
"Those plates are empty," Call pointed out. Rufus reached into his pocket, bringing out a package of bologna and then a loaf of bread. Two things that couldn't possibly have fit in there.
So they are. But not for long.
He opened the bologna and made 3 sandwiches, placing each one on a plate, and then carefully cutting them in halves.
Now, picture your favorite meal.
Cole looked from Master Rufus to Tamara and Aaron. Was this some kind of magic that they were supposed to be doing? Was Master Rufus suggesting that if you pictured something delicious while you ate a bologna sandwich, the bologna would taste better? Could he read Cole's mind? What if the mages had been monitoring his thoughts the whole time and—
Cole!
Master Rufus intoned, making him jump.
Is anything the matter?
Can you hear my thoughts? Cole blurted out.
Master Rufus blinked at him once, slowly, like one of the creepy lizards on the magisterium ceiling.
Tamara, can I read Cole's thoughts?
Mages can only read your thoughts if you're projecting them, she said.
Master Rufus nodded.
And by projecting? What do you think she means, Aaron?
Thinking really hard, he answered after a moment.
Yes,
said Master Rufus.
So please, think very hard.
Cole thought about his favorite foods, going over and over them in his mind. He kept getting distracted by other stuff, though, stuff that would be really funny if he pictured. Like a pie that was baked inside a cake, or 37 Twinkies stacked in the shape of a pyramid. Then, Master Rufus brought up his hands and Cole forgot to think of anything. The first sandwich began to spread, tendrils of bologna unfurling, coils growing across the plate. Delicious smells rose from it. Aaron leaned in, clearly hungry despite the chips he'd eaten on the bus. The bologna coalesced into a plate, a bowl, and a carafe. The bowl was full of macaroni and cheese covered in breadcrumbs, steaming as though it had just come out of an oven. The plate held a brownie heaped with ice cream, and the carafe was full of an amber liquid that Cole guessed was apple juice.
Wow, Aaron said, astonished. It's exactly what I pictured. But is it real?
Master Rufus nodded.
As real as the sandwich. You might recall the 4th principle of magic. You can change a thing's shape, but not its essential nature. And since I didn't alter the food's nature, it was truly transformed. Now you, Tamara.
Cole wondered whether that meant Aaron's mac and cheese would taste like bologna. But at least it appeared Cole wasn't the only one who didn't remember the principles of magic. Tamara stepped forward to take her tray as her food formed. It held a big plate of sushi, with a lump of green stuff on one end and a bowl of soy sauce on the other. With it was another plate with 3 round pink mochi balls. She'd received hot green tea to drink, and actually looked happy about it. Then it was Cole's turn. He reached for his tray skeptically, not sure what he would find, but it really did hold his favorite dinner, chicken fingers with ranch dressing for dipping, a side bowl of spaghetti with tomato sauce, and a peanut butter sandwich with cornflakes for dessert. In his mug was hot chocolate with whipped cream and colored marshmallows dotted over the top. Master Rufus looked pleased.
And now, I leave you to settle in. Someone will be along soon with your things.
Can I call my father? Cole asked. I mean, is there a phone I could use? I don't have one of my own.
There was a silence. Then Master Rufus said, more gently than Cole expected,
Cellular phones don't work in the Magisterium, Column. We're too far below ground for that. Nor do we have landline phones. We use the elements to communicate. I would suggest we give Alistair some time to calm down, and then you and I will contact him together.
Cole bit back any protest. It hadn't been a mean no, but it was a definite no.
Now, Master Rufus went on. I expect the three of you up and dressed at 9 tomorrow, and furthermore, I will expect you to be sharp-witted and ready to learn. We have much work to do together, and I would be very sorry if you didn't live up to the promise you showed at the trial.
Cole guessed that he meant Tamara and Aaron, since if he lived up to his promise, it would mean setting the underground river on fire. After Master Rufus left, they sat down on stalagmite stools at the smooth stone table to eat together.
What if you get ranch dressing on your spaghetti?
Asked Tamara, glancing at Cole's plate with her chopsticks poised in the air.
Then it will be even more delicious, said Cole.
Gross,
said Tamara, dabbing her wasabi into her soy sauce without splashing a drop outside the dish.
Where do you think they got fresh fish for your sushi, since we're in a cave?
Cole asked, popping a chicken finger in his mouth.
Bet they took a net down to one of those underground pools and nabbed whatever came up. Glurp, lurp.
Guys, said Aaron in a long-suffering way, you're putting me off my macaroni.
Glurp, lurp,
said Cole again, closing his eyes and waving his head back and forth like an underground fish. Tamara picked up her food and stalked over to the couches, where she sat down with her back to Cole and began eating. They finished the rest of their food in silence. Despite hardly having eaten all day, Cole couldn't finish his dinner. He pictured his father at home, eating at the cluttered kitchen table. He missed all of it, more than he'd ever missed anything. Cole shoved back his tray and stood up.
I'm going to go to bed.
Which one is mine?
Aaron leaned back in his chair and looked over.
Our names are on the doors.
Oh, Cole said, feeling foolish and a bit creeped out. His name was there, picked out in veins of quartz. Colum Hunt. He went inside. It was a luxurious room, much bigger than his room at home. A thick rug covered the stone floor. It was woven with the repeating patterns of the five elements. The furniture seemed to be made of petrified wood. It shone with a sort of soft golden glow. The bed was huge and covered with thick blue blankets and big pillows. There was a wardrobe and a chest of drawers. But since Cole had no clothes to put away and no stuff coming, he flopped down on the bed and put the pillow over his face. It only helped a little bit. Out in the common room he could hear Tamara and Aaron giggling. They hadn't been talking like that before. They must have been waiting for him to leave. Something was poking into his side. He had forgotten about the dagger his father had given him. Pulling it out of his belt, he looked at it in the torchlight.
Semiramis.
He wondered what the word meant. He wondered if he would spend the next 5 years alone in this room with his weird knife while people laughed at him. With a sigh, he dropped the knife onto the bedside table, kicked his feet under the blankets, and tried to go to sleep. But it was hours before he did.
Chapter 6.
Cole woke up to a sound like someone screaming in his ear. He threw himself sideways and fell off the bed, landing in a crouch and banging his knee against the cavern floor. The horrible sounds went on and on, echoing through the walls. The door of his room flew open as the screams began to die away. Aaron appeared, and then Tamara. They were both wearing first-year uniforms, gray cotton tunics over loose-fitting pants made of the same material. Both of them had their iron cuffs clamped around their wrists. Tamara's on her right wrist, Aaron's on his left. Tamara had done her long hair in two dark braids on either side of her head.
Ow!
Call said, sitting back on his heels.
It was just the bell, Aaron told him. It means it's time for breakfast.
Call had never been woken up for school by an alarm before. His father had always come in and woken him by shaking his shoulder gently until Call rolled over, sleepy-eyed and grumbling. Call swallowed hard. Missing home, fiercely. Tamara pointed behind Call, her perfectly tweezed eyebrows raised.
Did you sleep with your knife?
A glance back at the bed showed that the knife his father had given him had been knocked off his bedside table, probably struck by one of his flailing arms, and onto his pillow. He felt his cheeks get hot.
Some people have stuffed animals, Aaron said with a shrug. Other people have knives.
Tamara crossed the room to sit on his bed, picking up the blade as Call pulled himself to his feet. He didn't hang on to the post of the bed to keep his balance, even though he wanted to. With his clothes crumpled from sleeping and his hair sticking up everywhere, he was conscious of them watching him and of how slowly he had to move to avoid twisting his already hurting leg.
What does it say?
Tamara asked, holding the knife up and turning it at an angle.
Down the side. Semi-ram-miss?
Upright. Call said, I bet you're pronouncing it wrong.
And I bet you don't even know what the name means.
Tamara smirked. It hadn't even occurred to Call that the word on the blade was the knife's name. He didn't really think of knives as things that had names, though he supposed King Arthur had Excalibur, and in The Hobbit, Bilbo had Sting.
You should call her Miri for short, Tamara said, handing it back to him. She's a nice knife. Really well made.
Call searched her expression to see if she was mocking him.
But she seemed serious.
Apparently she respected a good weapon.
Miri,
he repeated, turning the knife over in his hand so that light sparked off the blade.
Come on, Tamara, said Aaron, tugging on her sleeve. Let Call get dressed.
I don't have a uniform,
Call admitted.
Sure you do. It's right there.
Tamara pointed to the foot of the bed as Aaron pulled her out of the room.
We all got them. They must have been brought by air elementals.
Tamara was right. Someone had left a neatly folded uniform, exactly Call's size, on top of his blanket, along with a leather school bag.
When had that happened?
When he was asleep? Or had he really not noticed it the night before? He put it on warily, shaking it out first in case there were any sharp bits or buttons that might stick him. The material was smooth and soft and completely comfortable. The boots he found resting beside the bed were heavy and held Call's weak ankle in a vice grip, steadying it. The only problem was that there was no pocket to put Miri in. Eventually he wrapped the knife in his old sock and stuck it in the top of his boot. Then he pulled the strap of the leather bag over his head and went out into the common room where Tamara and Aaron were sitting, while a glowering Master Rufus stood over them with his arms folded.
The three of you are late, he said.
The morning alarm is a call to breakfast in the refectory. It's not your personal alarm clock. This had better not happen again, or you will miss breakfast entirely.
But we...
Tamara began, starting to look toward Call. Master Rufus swung his gaze to her, pinning her in place.
Are you going to tell me that you were ready and someone else made you late, Tamara? Because then I would tell you that it is the responsibility of my apprentices to look after one another, and the failure of one is the failure of all. Now, what was it you were about to say?
Tamara lowered her head, braids swinging.
"Nothing, Master Rufus," she said.
He nodded once, opened the door and swept out into the hall, leaving them to follow him. Cole limped toward the door, hoping fervently that this wouldn't be a long walk and hoping even more fervently that he could avoid getting in more trouble before he got something to eat. Suddenly, Aaron appeared next to him. Cole almost yelped in surprise. Aaron had an amazing habit of doing that, he thought, clicking into place beside him like a determined blonde magnet. He bumped Cole's shoulder and looked meaningfully down at his hand. Cole followed his gaze and saw that there was something dangling from Aaron's fingers. It was Cole's wristband.
"Put it on,"
Aaron whispered.
"Before Rufus sees. You're supposed to wear them all the time."
Cole groaned, but he took the band and clicked it on to his wrist, where it glinted, gunmetal gray, like a handcuff. "That makes sense," Cole thought. "After all, I'm a prisoner here." As Cole had hoped, the refectory wasn't far away. It didn't sound that different from his school cafeteria from a distance, the din of kids talking, the clatter of cutlery. The refectory was in another large cavern with more of the giant pillars that looked like melted ice cream turned to stone. Chips of mica sparkled in the rock, and the roof of the cave disappeared into shadow above their heads. It was too early in the morning for Cole to be overly awed by the grandeur, though. He really just wanted to go back to sleep and pretend yesterday had never happened, and that he was home, with his father, waiting for the bus to take him to his regular school, where they let him wear regular clothes and sleep in a regular bed and eat regular food. It certainly wasn't regular food that waited for him at the front of the refectory. Steaming stone cauldrons, along one side, held an assortment of bizarre-looking food. Stewed purple tubers. Greens, so dark they were almost black, fuzzy lichen, and a red speckled mushroom cap as large as a pizza, and sliced up like a pie. Brown tea floating with pieces of bark steamed in a nearby bowl. Kids in uniforms of blue, green, white, red and gray, each color denoting a different magisterium year, were ladling it into carved wooden cups. Their wristbands flashed in gold and silver and copper and bronze, many with various colored stones attached. Cole wasn't sure what the stones signified, but they looked pretty cool. Tamara was already putting a scoop of the green stuff onto her plate. Aaron, however, was staring at the selection, with the same expression of horror that Cole felt.
"Please tell me that Master Rufus is going to turn this into something else," Aaron said.
Tamara bit back a laugh and looked almost guilty. Cole got the feeling she didn't come from a family where people laughed very much.
"You'll see," she said.
"Will we?"
Drew squeaked. He seemed a little lost without his pony t-shirt, now dressed plainly in the high-necked gray tunic and pants that was the uniform of the Iron Year students. He reached dubiously for a bowl of lichen, knocked it over, and then edged away, pretending it hadn't been him. One of the mages behind the tables. Cole had seen her and her elaborate snake necklace at the trial, sighed, and went to clear it up. Cole blinked as her snake necklace seemed to move for a second. Then he decided he was seeing things. He probably was suffering from caffeine withdrawal.
"Where's the coffee?"
he asked Aaron.
"You can't drink coffee,"
Aaron said, squinting as he took a slice of mushroom. "It's bad for you. Stunts your growth."
"But I drank it all the time back home,"
Cole protested.
"I always drink coffee. I drink espresso."
Aaron shrugged, which seemed to be his default move when presented with some new column-related craziness.
"There's that weird tea."
"But I love coffee."
Cole told the green sludge in front of him, plaintively.
"I miss bacon," said Celia, who was behind Cole in line.
She had a new bright clip in her hair, this one a ladybug. Despite how cheery it looked, she appeared woebegone.
"Caffeine withdrawal makes you crazy," he told her. "I could snap and kill someone."
She giggled like he'd made a really funny joke. Maybe she thought he had. She was pretty, he realized, with her blonde hair and the spray of freckles across her slightly sunburned nose. He remembered that, along with Jasper and Gwenda, she was one of Master Milagros's apprentices. A wave of sympathy swept over him that she had to live in the same room as a weenus like Jasper.
"He could kill someone,"
Tamara said casually, looking back over her shoulder.
"He has a huge knife in his—" "Tamara!"
Aaron interrupted her. She gave him an innocent smile before heading back to Master Rufus's table with her plate. For the first time, Cole wondered if he had something in common with Tamara after all, an instinct for troublemaking. The whole room was filled with stone tables, at which groups of apprentices sat on stools. Some second and third years with their masters, and some without. The Iron Year students were all clustered with their masters. Jasper, Celia, Gwenda, and a boy named Nigel with Master Milagros, the pink in her hair very bright today. Drew, Rafe, and a girl named Laurel with grouchy-looking Master Lemuel. Only a very few students in the white and red uniforms of fourth and fifth years were present, and they all sat together in a corner, having what appeared to be a very serious discussion.
"Where are the rest of the older kids?" Cole asked.
"On missions," said Celia. "Older apprentices learn in the field, and some grown-up mages come here to use the facilities for research and experiments."
"See?"
Cole said in a hushed tone.
"Experiments!"
Celia didn't seem particularly worried. She just grinned at Cole and moved off toward her master's table. Cole thumped into a chair between Aaron and Master Rufus, who was already seated before an austere breakfast containing a single clump of lichen. Cole's plate was covered in mushrooms and green stuff. He didn't remember doing that.
"I must be cracking up," he thought.
Then he took a forkful of mushroom and shoved it into his mouth. The taste exploded over his tongue. It was actually good, really good. Crispy at the edges, and a little bit sweet, like the way maple syrup tastes on sausages when everything runs together.
"Huh," Cole said, taking another bite.
But the greens were creamy and rich, like porridge with brown sugar. Aaron was shoveling spoonfuls of it into his mouth, looking astonished. He expected to see Tamara snickering at him for being so surprised, but she wasn't even looking. She waved across the room at a tall, slim girl with the same long, dark hair and perfect eyebrows as she had. A copper wristband glittered on the girl's wrist as she lifted her hand in a lazy wave.
"My sister," Tamara said proudly. "Kimaya."
Cole looked over at the girl, sitting at a table with a few other students in green and Master Rockmaple, and then back at Tamara. He wondered what it would be like to be happy here, to be glad you were chosen, instead of its being a terrible accident. Tamara and her sister seemed so totally confident that this was a good place, that this wasn't the evil lair his father had described. But why would his dad lie? Master Rufus was slicing his lichen in a very strange way, segmenting it like individual pieces of bread in a loaf. Then he cut each of those pieces in half, and half again. This freaked Cole out so badly that he turned to Aaron and asked, "So, do you have any family here?"
No, Aaron said, glancing away from Call as though he didn't like talking about it. No family anywhere. I heard about the Magisterium from a girl I used to know. She saw this trick I did sometimes when I was bored. Make dust motes dance around and form into shapes. She said she had a brother who went here, and even though he wasn't supposed to tell her about it, he had. After he graduated and she left to go live with him, I started practicing for the trial. Cole squinted at Aaron across his pile of mushrooms. There was something about the too casual way he told the story that made Cole wonder if maybe there was more to it. He didn't want to ask, though. He hated it when people pried into his life. Maybe Aaron did, too. Aaron and Cole lapsed into silence, pushing their food around their plates. Tamara went back to eating. From the other side of the hall, Jasper De Winter was waving his arms, clearly trying to get her attention. Cole nudged her with his elbow, and she scowled at him. Rufus took a small, precise bite of lichen.
I see the three of you have grown very close already.
No one said anything. Jasper's gestures at Tamara were growing somewhat wilder. He was clearly urging her to do something, though Cole couldn't tell what. Jump in the air? Throw her porridge? Tamara turned back to Master Rufus, taking a deep breath as though steeling herself to do something she didn't particularly want to do.
Do you think you would ever reconsider about Jasper? I know it was his dream to be picked by you, and there's room for more in our group.
She stopped speaking, probably because Master Rufus was looking at her like a raptor bird about to bite off the head of a mouse. When he finally spoke, though, his tone was cool, not angry.
The three of you are a team. You're going to work together and fight together. And, yes, even eat together for the next 5 years. I have chosen you not just as individuals, but as a combination. No one else will be joining you, because that would alter the combination.
He stood up, pushing his chair back with a solid thwack.
Now, rise. We go to our first lesson.
Cole's education in the use of magic was about to begin. Chapter 7. Cole was prepared for a long and miserable walk through the caverns, but Master Rufus led them down a straight corridor to an underground river instead. It looked to Cole a little like a subway tunnel in New York. He'd gone to the city with his dad on the hunt for antiques and remembered looking down into the darkness, waiting for the glow of lights that signaled a train. His gaze followed the river the same way, although now he wasn't sure what he was looking for, or what it might signal. A sheer rock wall rose behind them, and water flowed swiftly past them into a smaller cave where they could see only shadows. A damp, mineral smell was in the air, and along the shore were 7 gray boats tied up in a neat row. They were constructed of wooden planks, each overlapping the other along the side and meeting at the front, affixed with copper rivets, all of it making them look like tiny Viking ships. Cole looked around for oars, or a motor, or even a big pole, but he couldn't see any way to propel the boats.
Go ahead, said Master Rufus. Get in.
Aaron scrambled into the first of the boats, reaching out his hand to help Cole inside. Resentfully, Cole took it. Tamara got in behind them, looking a little nervous herself. As soon as she was settled, Master Rufus stepped into the boat.
This is the most common way we get around the Magisterium, using the underground rivers. Until you can navigate,
I will take you through the caves. Eventually, each of you will learn the paths and how to coax the water to take you where you want to go."
Master Rufus leaned over the side of the boat and whispered to the water. There was a soft ripple across the surface, as if the wind had stirred it, even though there was no wind underground. Aaron leaned forward to ask another question, but all at once the boat began to move, and he fell back into his seat. Once, when Call had been a lot younger, his father had taken him to a big park with rides that started like this. He'd cried through all of them, totally terrified, despite the cheerful music and the animated dancing puppets. And those had been rides. This was real. Call kept thinking about bats and sharp rocks and how sometimes, in caves, there were cliffs and holes that dropped down like a million feet below sea level. How were they going to be able to avoid stuff like that? How were they going to know if they were going the right way in the dark? The boat cut through the water into darkness. It was the darkest darkness Call had ever experienced. He couldn't even see his hand in front of his face. His stomach lurched. Tamara made a tiny sound. Call was glad it wasn't just him who was freaked out. Then, all around them, the cave came to glowing life. They passed into a room where the walls shimmered with pale, bioluminescent green moss. The water itself turned to light where the prow of the boat touched it. When Aaron dragged his hand through the river, it lit around his fingers, too. He flicked water into the air, and it transformed into a cascade of sparks.
Cool!
Aaron breathed. It was kind of cool. Call started to relax as the boat slipped silently through the glowing water. They passed walls of rock striped in dozens of colors and rooms where long, pale vines hung from the ceiling, trailing tendrils in the river. Then they would slide again into a dark tunnel and emerge into a new stone chamber where quartz stalactites sparkled like knife blades, or where the stone seemed to grow naturally into the shapes of curved benches, even tables. They passed two silent masters in one chamber playing checkers with pieces that flew through the air.
"Got you,"
said one of them, and the wooden discs started to rearrange themselves, resetting the board to the beginning. As though it were being steered by some invisible hand, the boat docked itself near a small platform with stone steps, rocking gently in place. Aaron was out of the boat first, followed by Tamara, and then Call. Aaron reached out a hand to help him, but Call deliberately ignored it. He used his arms to flip himself over the side of the boat, landing awkwardly. For a moment, he thought he was going to fall backward into the river, making a huge bioluminescent splash. A large hand clamped down on his shoulder, steadying him. He looked up in surprise, to see Master Rufus watching him with a strange expression. "I don't need your help," Call said, startled. Rufus said nothing. Call couldn't read his expression at all. He took his hand off Call's shoulder.
"Come,"
he said, and stalked up a smooth path that cut through the pebbly shore. The apprentices scrambled to follow. The path led up to a blank granite wall. When Rufus put his hand to the stone, it turned transparent. Call wasn't even surprised. He'd come to expect weirdness. Rufus walked through the wall as if it were made of air. Tamara ducked after him. Call looked at Aaron, who shrugged. Taking a deep breath, Call followed. He emerged into a chamber whose walls were bare rock. The floor was completely smooth stone. In the center of the room was a pile of sand.
First, I wish to go over the 5 principles of magic. You may remember some of these from your first lecture on the bus. But I don't expect any of you, even you, Tamara, no matter how many times your parents have drilled you, to truly comprehend them until you have learned many more things. You may write these down, however, and I do expect you to think on them.
Call scrambled with his pack and tugged out what appeared to be a hand-stitched notebook and one of those annoying pens from the trial. He shook it lightly, hoping it wasn't going to explode this time. Master Rufus began to speak, and Call scrambled to transcribe fast enough. He wrote, 1. Power comes from imbalance. Control comes from balance. 2. All elements act according to their nature. Fire wants to burn. Water wants to flow. Air wants to rise. Earth wants to bind. Chaos wants to devour. 3. In all magic, there is an exchange of power. 4. You can change a thing's shape, but not its essential nature. 5. All elements have a counterweight. Fire is the counterweight of water. Air is the counterweight of earth. The counterweight of chaos is the soul.
During the tests, said Master Rufus, all of you displayed power. But without focus, power is nothing. Fire can either burn down your house or warm it. The difference is in your ability to control the fire. Without focus, working with the elements is very dangerous. I don't need to tell some of you just how dangerous.
Call looked up, expecting to be the one who Master Rufus was staring at, since Master Rufus seemed to always be looking at Call when he said something ominous. This time, however, he was looking at Tamara. Her cheeks flushed, and her chin went up defiantly.
4 days a week, you 3 will train with me. On the 5th day, there will be a lecture by one of the other mages, and then, once a month, there will be an exercise in which you will put what you have learned to use. On that day, you may find yourselves either competing against or working with other apprentice groups. Weekends and nights are yours for practice and further study. There is the library as well as practice rooms, and the gallery, where you can waste time. Do you have any questions for me before we begin your first lesson?
No one spoke. Call wanted to say something about how he'd love some directions to that gallery place, but he held himself back. He remembered telling his father back at the hangar that he was going to get himself thrown out of the magisterium, but he'd woken up that morning with the sinking feeling that maybe that wasn't such a good idea. Trying to flunk the tests in front of Rufus hadn't worked after all, so acting out might not either. Master Rufus clearly wasn't going to let him communicate with Alistair until Call settled in as an apprentice. As much as it galled him to do it, he probably had to be on his best behavior until Rufus relaxed and let him contact his father. Then, when he could finally talk to Alistair, they'd plan his escape. He just wished he felt a little more enthusiastic about running away.
Very well. Can you guess why I've set up the room this way, then?
I'm guessing you need help fortifying your sandcastle, muttered Call under his breath. Even his best behavior apparently wasn't all that good. Aaron, standing beside him, stifled a laugh. Master Rufus raised a single brow but didn't otherwise acknowledge what Call had said.
I want you 3 to sit in a circle around the sand. You can sit any way that you're the most comfortable. Once you're ready, you must concentrate on moving the sand with your mind. Feel the power in the air around you. Feel the power in the earth. Feel it rise up through the soles of your feet and in the breaths you take.